everybody. Our next speaker is the high school specialist over with the Secular Student Alliance. And as I understand it, that means his job is to lay the smackdown on school administrators and principals who don't understand the separation of church and state. He also is a frequent contributor on his blog, which is now on the Freethought Blogs Network, What Would JT Do? You should check it out if you haven't seen it before. But JT is perhaps most well-known for his role as the lead organizer for the Skepticon series of conferences. Woo is right. Which he also, co-founded the Missouri State University Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And so for those who don't know about Skepticon, it's one of the largest skeptics conferences in the country, period. And it's run by students, and it's entirely free to attend. And, just consider for a moment how expensive and how difficult it is to put together a conference of that caliber, and think about how just crazy it is to make it free to attend. And then as crazy as that is, think about the idea of having it run totally by busy student volunteers. I don't know how anyone could think that was a good idea, but JT pulled it off.
I was going to say, up until that point, my head was going to get so big I couldn't get out of the auditorium. But then he capped it off with, oh, it was a dumb idea.
But what I can say is that I'm confident that without JT's trailblazing leadership with Skepticon, there would be no Free Thought Festival, because he really he showed what it was possible and really raised the bar for what student groups like my own can do. So please join me in welcoming JT Eberhardt.
I'm JT. I write a blog at Freethought Blogs. I'm collecting links for Free Viagra because Valerie is a porn star in atheism, and Daryl Ray probably has enough. I work for a group called the Secular Student Alliance, and we are winning at secular activism on the high school and college level. Liz Liddell, my boss, is going to be here later. You can talk to her. You can talk to me. Oh, there's Liz right there. We have a matching offer going right now. If you want to donate to the SSA, everything up to $250,000 will be matched. So if you have a spare $250,000 or a spare $5, Liz is the one there in the middle. This is our campus organizing team on pretty much a normal day. She'll be speaking here tomorrow. Okay, so why the arguments for God's existence suck? And before I get into that, I have to talk about why we suck at talking about God. We suck. We're terrible at it. We're really good at sitting in our own little groups and saying, oh, look, here's another complicated way we can know that we're right about God not existing. We're terrible about going to religious people and actually talking to this and talking in a language they can understand, because people want their worldviews boiled down to something that could fit on a bumper sticker. Who's rocking out? Is it? But they do. They want their worldview, in two sentences. This is why it's Adam and Eve and not Adam and Steve is so popular, right? So we suck at boiling it down to something simple that they can really comprehend. So I'm going to talk to you about how we can get better at that. First, this is the depressing part of the talk. Why do we even need to argue? I said this is the depressing part. The 11-year-old girl on your left there is Madeline Newman. She's 11 years old. At one point, she turned purple. She collapsed to the floor of her house, and her parents didn't take her to the hospital. Why? It's an easy answer for anybody in this audience. They prayed and prayed and prayed until ultimately she stopped breathing, and they prayed their child to death. Madeline died of type 2 diabetes, a completely treatable illness. Now, if the word bad is to have any meaningful definition, parents who watch while their child dies are bad. You might even call them monsters. But there's something very important to note here. These parents love their daughter as much as you or I would love our child. They wanted their daughter to get better just as much as any of us would. The problem's not, as Christians would have us believe, that there's something inherently malicious in the human condition. The problem is that they had a bad idea about how the universe worked, and all the good intentions in the world were not enough to save them from it. If you have good intentions, it is a moral obligation for you to try to be as reasonable as possible to make sure that your good intentions are borne out in the results you see. This is why whenever a Christian tells me, oh yes, that those Christians are bad, but they're not my Christianity. Not good enough. You're only saying that those Christians are different. What matters is that you can tell me if you are more likely to be right, if you are more reasonable, because that's your moral obligation. And these are not, moral decisions are not made in a vacuum. The moral decisions of other people affect us. They affect our neighbors. So we need to be talking to people about whether or not they're being reasonable, and we need to hold their feet to the fire on it. But then what do we get? Oh, man, I'll never change anybody's mind. They're so closed-minded. We never get anywhere. Bullshit. Absolute bullshit. Sorry, Valerie. I want everybody in the room to raise your hands if you were once religious. I was. About everybody. Now, no, leave your hand in the air. Leave your hand in the air. And I want you to leave your hand in the air if some argument, whether Richard Dawkins and the God Delusion, or a friend of yours gave you some argument just at some point along the road that helped you to change your mind. Well, damn, that's almost everybody. I'll be dadgum. And then that's just the thing. You do not choose your beliefs. This is the message of Christianity. You need to choose to believe in Jesus. No one can do that. Your brain is an engine that generates this map of reality based on whatever facts are in your skull, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. And if you doubt that, try walking up to the edge of the roof of a building and trying to convince yourself just by force of will that gravity doesn't work. There's not a single person in this room that could do it, because we don't choose our beliefs. So once we get the right facts into someone's head, they're powerless. They're powerless to do anything else. And this is what kills me when people say, oh, they're just so closed-minded, we'll never get anywhere. Because it's taking the responsibility away from you. It's putting it on them. It's saying it's their fault and not yours for maybe, you know, looking for a way where you could improve your skills at communication, where you could refine your arguments to make them more listenable. That's on us, and we need to start taking that responsibility. All right, so there are certain tricks that'll get used to either get you off the subject or to get you to not talk about religion with people. I want to talk about some of those first. First one is respect. Groan. But the people who say this, and even the atheists who say it in the way that we're all thinking, they have a very finicky definition of respect. If I'm wrong about something, tell me. Please tell me. I want to change my mind. I want you to assume that I would want to change my mind. A lot of people hear the word respect and they make it synonymous. Tell them we're busy. And they make it synonymous with placating someone, as if they didn't have the fortitude to withstand some criticisms about their belief. We can work with religious people and coexist without creating this culture of condescending one another and then treating it as respect. Tell people what you think. Help them to be better, reasonable people. Religious people will confuse the questions. You'll ask them, why do you believe what you believe? And they will answer the question, what do you believe? Wrong answer. We need to be holding them to the reasons they believe these things. So when you say, why do you believe what you believe? And they say, well, Jesus on the cross and Adam and Eve and original sin. Like, no. Why? What reasons? What evidence? Don't let them dovetail you like that. Another thing is they'll say, well, isn't it just possible that God exists? Or isn't it possible that my religion is true? And yes, it's true. There is a non-zero possibility their religion is true. There's a non-zero possibility that unicorns exist. We're talking about religion, Charlie. But we're not arguing about possibility. We're arguing about plausibility. You can concede possibility, but that's not enough. They need to establish why this is most likely true. And possible is just not enough. The last one, well, can't we agree to disagree? What is morally true is dependent on what is actually true. If the God a lot of religious people believe in actually exists, we probably shouldn't let gay people marry. But it all hinges on whether or not that God exists. And right now we've got all these people who are saying, I'm right morally. We need to legislate on my morality. And nobody wants to say, well, that God doesn't exist. Or, I can defend that my God exists. And so we wind up frozen in our moral discourse, unable to move forward. So when someone says, we need to agree to disagree, they're inviting us to stay balkanized like that. And the only answer can be, how about no? All right, so the meat of the talk, the arguments. There's one argument they need to address. One argument, period. And that is, there is no evidence for the existence of God. If you are not giving me evidence for the existence of God, you are answering the wrong question. And they'll try to take it off into other ways, like red herrings. Atheists are great big meanies. We could be fucking murderers and it would not make us wrong. It's a complete red herring. Science can't explain what the hell ever. And they'll do this. They'll try to get you to, like, if you go on without pointing this out, they score a point. The word can't. How do you know science can't explain something? Like, science hasn't explained what the hell ever. And even if we haven't, that doesn't mean that you have. Okay. When there's something we haven't explained, there's a proper way to handle our ignorance there. I don't know. Unless we have evidence for something else. If you have evidence for God, you can put it in there. But if the way you deal with human ignorance is to make human ignorance equal to God, you've created a scenario where you are worshiping your own ignorance because you've called it God. Or you've created a scenario where God is the equivalent of this quality we're trying to purge from humanity. And either way, you're not doing yourself or God any favors. So I've made this healthy flowchart to help. Is this a piece of evidence to God's existence? If yes, proceed. If not, stay on target. If they are answering any other question other than, why do you believe God exists? You are not doing your job of holding their feet to the fire. So what's next? You can't prove God doesn't exist. Groan. But here's the deal. They're getting used to this one. Well, you can't prove Smurfs don't exist. They don't have a good answer, but they've heard it enough to where they think that, well, God is real and Smurfs aren't, is a good answer to that question. We need to get them to use conventional logic, the same logic they use in every other part of their lives, when they get to the God question. So what is the two-sentence way to do that? Well, I'll tell you, nowadays when someone says, you can't prove God doesn't exist, the first words out of my mouth are, you're a thief. I say, what? I say, you're a thief. You steal shit. That's bad. Stop it. I'll say, I'm not a thief. Like, prove you're not a thief. And the next words out of their mouth are invariably, well, there's no evidence that I'm a... And it takes them off their script and it makes them think. This is our job, and it can be done quickly, concisely, and in a way that communicates to them, in a way that makes sure that cognitive dissonance sets in. All right, next, they'll be like, oh, but science and religion are totally compatible. And how many of us have seen people like go and like start using all kinds of polysyllabic, you know, scientific words having this argument? There's no reason to. I mean, this is Ray Comfort's whole spiel, right? And if I'm telling you right now, if you start talking to religious people, like normal religious people, like in church and stuff, they listen to this guy and they regurgitate it, all right? But you don't need to make it this huge, complex issue. Because, like, take just someone rising from the dead. I mean, this is the province of biology. Biologists have something to say about people rising from the dead. And all Christians believe this. Or someone walking on water. I mean, this is something that physicists might have a bone to pick with. Or the idea of someone could be converted into a pillar of salt. I mean, this is chemistry, right? And you think this is compatible? Or how about a global flood that somehow left no evidence? I mean, geologists might just shit a brick at this idea. And even if the geologists have nothing to say about this, the historians do have something to say about it. This is Richard Carrier, my hero. The historians do have something to say about it because lots of civilizations, like Egypt's sixth dynasty, made copious records of their civilization when the flood was supposed to have taken place, somehow missed dying. Pretty resilient folk, those Egyptians. But then you'll hear, but there are religious scientists. And it's true, there are religious scientists. But the thing is, they're not religious for scientific reasons. Otherwise, they'd be publishing papers on God's existence in peer review. We'd be reading about it in textbooks. But JT, there are groups, totally secular groups, like the Discovery Institute, who are trying to publish papers. And they're trying. Trying being the operative word. Never succeeded. So even if someone is regurgitating their stuff to you in language you don't understand, because you're not a science major, it doesn't matter that you can't respond to them. All you have to say is that the experts disagree. And it's not just that the experts disagree, but if they have this information that could confirm God exists and get it into textbooks and the scientific consensus, why the hell are they telling you? I mean, you guys are students and plumbers and waiters and music majors. I mean, when real scientists make a discovery, do you think they like run up to waiters and be like, hey, I've made this cool scientific discovery. Let's start a grassroots movement to get it into textbooks. No! They go to scientists to make sure their work is correct and that the Discovery Institute, Christians, is rushing to you with this stuff and not to the scientists, should tell you something. It should say not only a great amount about them, it should say a great amount about what they think of you. And in the future, you should probably remember who they are and how they operate. We all defer to the experts. They'll say, like, oh, argument to authority, but we all defer to experts. If you like having plentiful food, if you like iPhones, flying on airplanes, you're deferring to the experts. We can't live long enough to become experts on everything. We have to defer to the experts. Now, if you disagree with the experts, what does your position look like? I mean, to you, science must be the greatest coup in the history of ever. Just laying low for thousands of years, unveiling the mysteries of the universe, giving us plentiful food, clean water, medicine, computers, laptops, pornography on the internet. Internet is for porn. Only so that just now, thousands of years later, they can mislead us on evolution. They don't realize it, but this is the scenario they're painting. And you need to tell them, just as concisely, that this is completely implausible. If you believe that people rise from the dead, you're on the wrong side of science, period. All right, so then they'll be like, oh, but everything's ordered. It all looks designed. And does the universe look designed? Well, no. The universe creates order all by itself, which is exactly the universe we would expect to find ourselves in if there was no God. Take snowflakes, for instance. Far more complex than liquid water, unique, each and every one, but who feels the need to invoke a snowflake-making God? Nobody, because we know the natural processes that create that order all by themselves, and it's the same from stars to DNA replication to literally everything. In fact, as Richard Carrier famously says, there was once a time when nothing was explained. Ever since that time, everything we have explained has been found to be the product of mindless forces acting on inanimate objects. How will all the rest turn out? So even for questions we haven't answered, such as the question from whence comes the universe, we need to look at the historical trend in discovered knowledge. And science is not finding God. It's finding natural causes, even for order and complexity. But JT, isn't science your religion? Isn't science a matter of faith? No! I want to vomit blood every time someone says this to me. It's a belief. But it's a belief that gets confirmed over and over again. Every time we drop a stone and can measure its rate of descent, it's confirmed. Every time we throw a satellite to the outer reaches of the solar system and hit something the size of a pinhead, it's confirmed that the universe is consistent, which is the only assumption science makes. It's confirmed over and over again. And even religious people live on the assumption that the universe is consistent. For instance, if you walk by a hot stove one week and burn your hand on it, you're not going to put your hand on the stove next week. Because you expect the universe to be consistent. It's also the reason why if you saw an animal talk, it would probably freak you the hell out. It's also the reason if you saw 20 animals talk, you'd start to get used to it. All we're asking of the religious people in terms of science and in terms of their own beliefs is that they stay consistent. They operate this way everywhere else. Stay consistent. But JT, what about the prophecies confirmed in the Bible? Let's talk about those. The vague prophecies. This is from Luke 7:27. This is the one about whom it is written, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare the way before you. This is not much of a prophecy. Here's one I made up last night, drunk. There will come a time when three evil men will rise to power and a woman will oppose them, leading the people against them. This will be fulfilled in the next 20 years, I'll bet anything. How much divine inspiration do I need? Here's my horoscope from today. I'll be damned, it's a miracle. Here's what I could do, a 21st century mortal with Google. In the second century Rome, there shall be five emperors, and they will be named Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antonius Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. Shouldn't God be able to do better than a mortal with Google? I mean, with being all-knowing and all. And this is the standard you should hold them to. So the presence of vague prophecies in the Bible kind of negates the idea of a God who's any wiser than me and Google. Trivial prophecies. How impressive is this? Tomorrow the sun will rise. The Bible's full of prophecies like this. Why don't they say something like, tomorrow the sun will not rise? Now that's a prophecy. But the Bible doesn't do that. When it does, it's invariably wrong. Or cheating. Jesus, if he existed, was a rabbi. He would have known the Jewish literature, so he would have known what prophecies he had to fulfill. The if he existed part is going to be tackled by Richard Carrier later in this session. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. This is from Zechariah 9:9. This will get brought up a lot. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. And this is not just conjecture on my part, because in Matthew 21:2 through 5, Jesus says, go to the village ahead of you, and at once you will find a donkey tied there with her colt by her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, tell them that the Lord needs them, and he will send them right away. This took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. Doesn't that seem like cheating? How difficult is it to fulfill a prophecy you already know about? Hint, not. God could do better. The presence of these in the Bible, even if they can come up with one that's like, oh, this is really a prophecy, why is it mixed in amongst these? Couldn't God have done better if he was really trying to communicate with us? All right, so this is a good time to talk to you about moving the goalposts, because they'll do it. We've gone through all these arguments so fast, which is what they'll do. You'll trash one, it'll be dead to rights, and they'll just move on to another as though nothing ever happened. But then when the next chump comes along, boy, they'll go right back to that argument. Don't let them do it. Keep them on it. If they go prophecy and you beat prophecy down, don't let them go to another one. Say, hold on. I want to help you make sure that we're on the same page here. And if this is a bad argument, we shouldn't use it in the future, right? And tie them down to it. Set in the cognitive dissonance and let them know there's a public accountability for being wrong. All right. But history. But no. But the Bible is so historically accurate, save for a moment that it's not. But even if it were totally historically accurate, I could take a history book compliant with history as we know it and write on the last page, and Elvis rose from the dead. The fact that it's historically accurate will not mean that Elvis rose from the dead. In fact, you can say to Christians, what is the two-line answer here? Right now, there are religions making their holy books, new religions making their holy books right now, and they will be historically accurate. Not because their religions are true, but because they were written at a point in history. Historical accuracy says nothing to the truth of miracle claims or the existence of God. And here's the good one. But I feel God. Yeah, all those arguments suck. I don't even know why I brought them up. But I feel God. And here's the deal. I think they're sincere. I think they're telling the truth. But what they don't realize is that our senses can kind of suck sometimes as far as giving us the right input information. So I'm here to tell you right now. Here's an example to prove this to you. Square A, square B are the exact same color. Now even, and here, I'll prove it to you. No, I did this down in Texas, and someone said, well, they just changed colors as it went down. Okay, let's try it again. And even when I make them go away, your brain will still tell you they're a different color because our senses are not always reliable. So how do we get around that? We get around it through science, through reason, through realizing that sometimes our brain is telling us wrong stuff. So I believe you have really fuzzy, warm feelings when you pray and that you interpret this as God speaking to you. I believe you. What you need to realize is that people have the same feelings when they pray to Allah, or when they pray to any other god, or when they meditate. So what is more likely? That a god exists who gets trashed by all these two-sentence rebuttals, or that this is just naturally what happens to your brain when you pray or when you focus on the idea of a god? And if one is more likely than the other, you need to change your mind. So what is the two-sentence rebuttal to this for you? Well, I'll tell you, the fact that your sensory inputs are not always reliable is something that allows magicians to make their living. So learn a magic trick. Brianna, come on up here. Brianna just started a high school group at a high school at Grand Rapids, Michigan. Give her a round of applause. I want you to hold your right arm out and pull your sleeve back. PZ, can you come up here? Come on. All right. Okay, now what I'm going to have PZ do, let me tie this knot here. What I'm going to have PZ do is I'm going to have him hold your hand. Aww. All right, now, he's doing that so there's no way I could pull this off the edge of your arm. So if I was going to get it off your arm, the only way I could do it, pull down for me real quick. One, two, three. Oh, God, I'm going to break your arm. Yeah, oh, my God. Hard. Please, for that? Oh, my God, I haven't done magic in forever. We're going to try that one more time. All right, PZ, there you go. Knock yourself out.
Okay.
All right, there we go, and there we go. And it's a knot, and you can examine it. So learn a magic trick. Because then you can say to them, you just saw this happen. Your senses told you this just went through her arm, or whatever magic trick you learn. What is more likely, that there's a natural explanation for why your senses were fooled, or that it's magic? And they'll acknowledge this on everything up to God, and you can use that to set in the cognitive dissonance. All right. Does God make people better? The moral argument. Since I'm running low on time, short answer, no. Prisons are full of religious people. And remember, we don't choose our beliefs, right? Can't choose gravity doesn't work. So how much sense does it say, or make of God to make me with a brain like that and say, you have to believe in something absurd or go to hell? Just choose to. I can't do that. It's impossible for me. God is kind of a jerk at making me with that brain. Or you'll hear with atheism, you can't have absolute morality. And there is no absolute morality. No, the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not lie. All the time? Because if you're harboring Jews in Nazi Germany and the Gestapo knock on your door, the moral thing to do is to lie your ass off. Morality changes based on our situations. And here's the catch-all at the end. But I have faith. Two-sentence response. Can you distinguish faith from gullibility for me? And if you can't, maybe faith isn't as noble as you thought. And if you say that religious faith means having reasons, good, we can talk about those reasons. And then these. God works in mysterious ways. Is there any evil or just stupid aspect of existence that can't be explained away that way? Is there any, seriously, argument so ludicrously at odds with reality that you can't defend it by saying God's ways are mysterious? If not, this might be a biased argument here. Or God's thinking is like so beyond ours, man, which only gets brought up when you're defending something incredibly stupid God did. God's so smart, he did this stupid thing. Or you can't judge God by human standards. Fuck, what other standards do we have? This is the standards he left us with. And these are the standards we use to establish God's goodness in the first place. So are these pieces of evidence that point to God's existence? No, they're excuses. You need to get them to stay on target. And the last one to get is, after you trash all their arguments, you've held their feet to the fire, but one day might we find evidence for God? Isn't that possible? Yes, it is possible, and at that point we'll change our minds, but not a second sooner. And if the basis for your belief in God is that we might find evidence somewhere down the line to confirm it, you are by definition basing your beliefs off information you don't have, which is a moral failing, period. So what is the moral take-home of this? You don't need 5 PhDs in everythingology to talk to people about God. You need common sense and the ability to tell when someone's trying to distract you with red herrings or bad arguments. And you need to realize that being reasonable is a responsibility we all share as human beings and teammates down here on Earth. and we need to start holding people accountable for it. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.